Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode... I have your daughter. On May 31st, 1985, 2 days before her high school graduation, Sherry Faye Smith was abducted from the driveway of her family home in South Carolina. For several days after the abduction, the kidnapper called and sent letters to the family, taunting them with details of the abduction and murder of Sherry. Ultimately, he revealed the location of Sherry's body on a phone call to Sherry's older sister, Dawn. But he wasn't finished. 2 weeks to the day of Sherry's abduction, the murderer snatched another victim, 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick, who came to a similar fate. The authorities realized they were dealing with a sadistic, narcissistic serial killer of young women. When a killer calls is the haunting story of murder, criminal profiling, and justice in a small town, written by John Douglas and Mark Olshaker. John and Mark have written 7 previous books together, including Mindhunter, the #1 New York Times bestseller that was the basis for the Netflix hit series of the same name. Mark drew the short straw, and he joins me today on Murder Most Foul. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim.
So, Mark, you are a return victim to Murder Most Foul. During your prior visit entitled Mindhunter, we discussed John's early career as founding chief of the investigative support unit at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. And also, he was one of the creators of the Crime Classification Manual. And you also discussed how specifically how criminal profiling has led to countless identifications and apprehensions of criminals over the decades. But when a killer calls is a little different. It's an engrossing narrative of a singular case of brutality and sadism in South Carolina. What was the impetus for you and John to come forward and tell this heart-wrenching story?
Why we did this case. As you've said, most of our previous books have been more general, have combined a lot of cases, have talked about different aspects of criminal investigative analysis, such as the hunt for motive or practical profiling and all of that. What happened was, after we published our book, The Killer Across the Table, which was really about the prison interviews that led to the whole concept of criminal profiling and investigative analysis as practiced by the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit, our editor, Matt Harper, we were meeting with him in New York, and he said, I'd like to start a series of books on individual cases. And we said, okay, that sounds interesting. And he said, which cases do you think would work for this? And what would be the criterion? And John and I looked at each other across the table. And I said, I think probably the best cases were the ones that, for one reason or another, affected John and the other investigators most on either an intellectual level, an emotional level, a spiritual level even. And we came up with 2 books to start the series. One, which we ended up calling The Killer's Shadow, was about the first really political, if you will, racist serial killer, Joseph Paul Franklin. And this was a man who was an excellent sniper. He traveled around the country, and he supported himself with bank robberies, which he was very good at. But that wasn't his main focus as a criminal. He wanted to kill black people, black couples, Jews, and people surrounding them, the people who and who foisted whatever evil he perceived on the body politic. And he was particularly upset by interracial couples, and which is why he targeted hustler publisher Larry Flint, who he didn't kill but left in a wheelchair for the rest of his life, because he didn't like the interracial. He didn't mind pornography, but he didn't like the interracial couplings in Hustler magazine. So the fact that there was a serial killer who was just this dedicated to racism and hate really affected the investigators on a profound level. So we figured that was a good one to start with. And then the next one was the Sherry Fay Smith case and Deborah Helmick case in Columbia, South Carolina, which was probably the most emotional and heartrending and gut-wrenching case of John's career, for reasons we can discuss, Jim. Sherry Fay Smith was a beautiful young high school senior, a blonde singer. She had mapped out her future. She was going to be going to college and studying music. She had a job for the summer at an amusement park where her older sister Dawn already sang and performed. And on Friday, May 31st, just before her graduation from high school, which was to take place that Sunday, and she was scheduled to sing the national anthem, she was abducted from in front of her house as she stopped her car to get the mail at the top of a long driveway. Her parents found her car with the motor still running, the door open, her purse left in the car, along with medicine that was critical for a medical condition she had. And she had just disappeared. Hilda Smith, the mother, called her sister, her Sherry Fay's sister, Dawn, in Charlotte, North Carolina, told her to come home. Her father called the South Carolina Sheriff's, the Lexington County, South Carolina Sheriff's Office. They arrived almost immediately, and Sheriff Jim Metz and Under Sheriff Lewis McCarty, who are great heroes of this story, they immediately began investigating and contacted Robert Ivey, who was the special agent in charge of the FBI's Columbia field office. Hundreds of searchers braved 108 degree heat to look for her. And on Sunday, June 2nd, when she hadn't shown up, the Lexington High School graduation went ahead without her. The next day, the Smiths got a call from presumably the what we call the unsub, the unknown subject, telling them to expect a letter from their daughter. That letter, which came the next day, it was intercepted at the post office by the sheriff's department and the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division SLED, some very good investigators and competent people, was on two sheets of lined paper, obviously from a pad, and it was in headlined Last Will and Testament. And this was from this 18-year-old girl, Sherry Smith, and essentially it said she knew she was going to die And it was the most profound and grace-filled letter of both resignation and faith that any of us have ever seen. It was absolutely heartbreaking. And yet, anybody who has read this book or knows anything about the case will attest to the courage, the character, the, I don't know what else, the faith, I don't know what else to call it, the grace, I would have to say grace, of this 18-year-old who knew she was going to die, whose whole life ahead of her, getting married, children, her singing career, her everything was being taken away from her. And she knew it, and yet she told her parents, her boyfriend, her siblings, to not to lose faith, to get along without her.
I love you, Mommy, Daddy, Robert, Dawn, and Richard, and everyone else, and all other friends and relatives. I'll be with my father now. So please, please don't worry. Just remember my witty personality and the great special times we all share together. Please don't let this ruin your lives. Just keep living one day at a time for Jesus. Some good will come out of this. My thoughts will always be with you. And in you. Closed casket. Love you so damn much. Sorry, Dad, I had to cuss for once. Jesus, forgive me. Richard, sweetie, I really did and always will love you and treasure our special moments. I am sorry if I ever disappointed you in any way. I only wanted to make you proud of me. Because I have always been proud of my family. Mom, Dad, Robert, and Dawn. There is so much that I should have said before now. I love you. I know y'all love me and will miss me very much. But you'll stick together like we always did. Y'all can do it. Please do not become hard or upset. Everything works out for the good. For those that love the Lord. All my love always. I love y'all with all my heart. P.S. Nana, I love you so much. I kind of always felt like your favorite. You were mine. I love you a lot. Sharon Sherry Smith.
And then this unknown subject, this killer, called again and kept tantalizing the family, but essentially eventually told them what had happened, that he and Sherry were one spirit now. I mean, his narcissism and his sadism were so apparent in this, and yet at the same time, his criminal sophistication were also, I mean, we don't think, Jim, of a kidnapper or a sexual serial killer as getting that close to the family. I mean, that's the last thing they generally want to do. But this guy, this was part of his signature, this becoming part of the family, insinuating himself into it, and yet being so sadistic and so narcissistic that it was all about him. And yet at the same time, he disguised his voice with an electronic device. He called from payphones, which he knew to get off of in time so that Trap and Trace couldn't send the police there in time to find him. By the time the police would arrive at each of these scenes, because there were repeated phone calls, they would find that the receiver and all of the equipment had been wiped clean of fingerprints. So he was very sophisticated. Eventually, he told Dawn, Sherry's older sister, where to find the body.
And 2 weeks to the day Sherry was abducted, another young lady, a girl, 9-year-old girl, disappears from the same area.
What's significant is Sherry was abducted on a Friday, May 31st. Deborah Mae Helmick, who was not 18, like or almost 18, like Sherry, she was 9 years old. She lived with her parents in a trailer park, also in the Columbia, South Carolina area. She was abducted 2 weeks to the day after Sherry Smith. You can just imagine what this 9-year-old girl went through. I mean, it is absolutely harrowing. You know, the whole thing is harrowing. And that this guy, you know, I'm at a loss for words almost to say how cruel and self-centered and egotistical and narcissistic he was. All he talked about was himself and his relationship with these. The Helmicks did not have a phone in their trailer home at the time, which is probably why he kept calling the Smiths. And they kept him on the phone as long as possible for all the obvious crime-solving reasons. But it was absolutely harrowing and devastating for them to have to do this. And I've implied this before, but the Smiths were a deeply, deeply religious family. They had tremendous faith. Bob Smith, the Sherry's father, did prison outreach. He was well known to the sheriff's office. They were big supporters of their church. Their faith maybe helped them in this, but it is so cruel to think of how their faith was tested by this horrible event. I mean, you can't think of anything worse. And then, meanwhile, while all this was happening, the FBI field office was sending all of these recordings and all of the physical evidence case file to Quantico so that John Douglas and his team of profilers could analyze it. They came up with a profile based on what they heard, because very seldom do you actually have the dialogue of the unsub himself.
As devastating as the letter, which was, the last will and testament of Sherry, the phone calls that continued afterwards were incredibly disturbing. It sounds like chit chat, but the family at first is trying to figure out, please from this guy, find out, is she still alive? And obviously it becomes pretty clear that she's not. But they're begging with him before. I'm sorry, it's unbelievable.
He continues to call, and there's another call at 9:45 p.m. that Tuesday, at which Hilda, the mother, gets on the phone, and Bell describes the kidnapping. And he says in very ominous terms, although totally narcissistic for him, Sherry and he became one soul. That immediately told the profilers that she was gone. The FBI had a case consultation meeting, including all of the great profilers that they had there, including Roy Hazelwood, one of the top experts on interpersonal violence. The next day, the unsub calls again and says that gave directions to find Sherry's body and said, God chose us, which, of course, all of these religious overtones, Jim, are just another narcissistic aspect to that. Little afternoon that day, Sherry's body was found, according to his directions, behind the Masonic Lodge in nearby, adjoining Saluda County. the SLED captain, remember that South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, Captain Leon Gask, goes to the Smith home and tells them what they found. The body is transported to a hospital for autopsy. By this point, the FBI has listened to all the recordings so far, and they begin a profile. Unsub continues to taunt them. And then Saturday, June 8th, which is, you know, a week and a day after Sherry was abducted, her funeral is held at their church. Now, what's interesting is Hilda had postponed the funeral for several days because Sherry was supposed to go on a senior class trip to the Bahamas with her classmates, and she had packed for it and everything. So Hilda wanted to wait till those classmates got back. That same afternoon after the funeral, another call comes in. Dawn takes it. He gives her more details. Crime Stoppers program down there does a recreation of the case to see if anybody knows anything. And then Friday, June 14th at 4:07 p.m., Deborah Mae Helmick is abducted. Her neighbor, Ricky Morgan, witnesses the abduction, rushes out, tries to stop the car. Sherwood Helmick, her father, and a friend, Johnny Flake, get in their car to pursue the abductor. Meanwhile, Lou McCarty, the deputy sheriff, has gone up to Quantico to meet with the BSU. The next day, or the day after that, McCarty convinces them that this is an ongoing case. They've now realized they've got a serial killer, and unless they stop him, there's going to be more. Maybe he will stay on this every 2 week cycle, but they don't know. So at that point, John Douglas and Ron Walker, the profiler who had taken the original call, travel to Columbia, South Carolina, where McCarty picks them up at the airport. They meet with Sheriff Metz at his office, and John says, "I will get him to call again." They then go to the Smith house, and John says, "Let me see Sherry's room." And they look at the room, and they realize that she has a whole collection of stuffed animals, which are very important to her. John picks out a small koala bear, stuffed koala bear, that actually, when you press it, it moves its arms. And he says, "I'm going to take this," and he starts formulating a plan. He also realizes when he meets Dawn that she looks very much like Sherry. They could be twins almost. And John realizes that the best way to get this unsub to come forward is to use Dawn as bait, which of course is an extremely risky strategy, but they're gonna give her every protection they can. Dawn agrees. She convinces her parents to let them do it. John then formulates a graveside ceremony in which this koala bear will be put on a post at the grave on Sherry's 18th birthday. And they hope that if they surveil the gravesite, that he will come out and they will get him that way. When he calls again, as John predicted, and he talks to Dawn and gives her and gives Dawn instructions to how to find Deborah May's body, he says the most eerie and chilling thing he will ever say, which is, "God wants you to join Sherry Fay." They do this graveside ceremony. Many people come. It's covered by the newspapers. Reporters write about it in a very emotional way. they don't know whether the unsub has been there or not. They take pictures and everything. This case is a classic of the combination of really good detective work, really good scientific evidence, and really excellent profiling and behavioral analysis, all of which eventually come together. So what happens is SLED technicians use what's called an ESBA machine. And what this does is they analyze the two-page last will and testament. And they're not analyzing it for anything obvious clues. They don't think Sherry Fay has been able to leave clues in there. But it's clearly from a pad of paper, you know, a legal pad or something like that. So what this machine does is it looks for slight indentations in the sheet, in what would have been the sheets on top of these pages. And what they find after several days of analysis and very meticulous investigation is what seems to be a grocery list, and then a string of numbers, nine numbers, which look like they may be a telephone number. So they have almost all the numbers. So they analyze this, and they come up with an exchange. The first three numbers show that it's Alabama. The next three numbers indicate a Huntsville, Alabama exchange. And then they go to the telephone company, and they fill in all the possibilities of what this missing number could be, and then call the one that the phone company said had actually had calls between Huntsville and Columbia, South Carolina. They then call the number and talk to a young man who's in the service. He's in the Army, and his name is Joe Shepard. And they think, maybe we've got an immediate hit. Could he be the killer? He's very forthcoming, though. He's friendly. He's cooperative. And they say, well, do you know anybody in Columbia, South Carolina? Because there seem to be some calls back and forth. And he immediately says, oh, yeah, my parents live there. I talk to them all the time. So they say, So the father's name is Ellis Shepard. So Lou McCarty then finds out where he lives, goes to the house. He brings a bunch of deputies with him in case this is violent. And turns out Ellis and his wife are two middle-aged people in their 50s. And they're very friendly. They're very cooperative. They said, oh, yeah, we talk to Joey all the time. And nothing in their demeanor or their background or anything fits the profile. So, you know, is this just another red herring or dead end in what was, what was a complicated case? Well, what did McCarty do at that point? He could give up, or he could say, well, wait a minute. He really did believe in the profile. And then he went through the profile with the Shepherds and the physical description. A white male in his 30s, portly, flabby, and of medium height, about 180 to 200 pounds, not very physically attractive, short, shaggy beard and hair, somewhat above average intelligence, but hadn't really done much with it. Married but divorced, possibly with a child he doesn't see. Currently living alone or with an older relative. Unsuccessful military career and early discharge. Worked in some blue-collar job, possibly involving electrical work. They concluded that because of the way he disguised his voice on the phone. And or home repair. Drove a several years old but well-maintained car. Consumed and collected bondage and sadomasochistic-oriented pornography. A meticulous list maker and rigid thinker who wrote down everything he wanted to remember, and who, if he was distracted from what he was saying, would start over at the beginning. McCarty didn't mention that he was probably involved in earlier sex crimes, because they didn't want to, this is not something that these people would necessarily know, and he didn't want to skew the evidence. But you know, this sounds like witchcraft, but each of these characteristics really comes from something in the profile, in the evidence, in the meticulousness with which he gave directions, the sophistication with which he avoided capture, all of that. And when McCarty finished going through this elaboration, they looked at each other and said, "Boy, that sounds just like Larry Jean Bell."
So now the unsub has a name, but who is he?
Well, he's an assistant electrician who worked with Ellis in his electrical and home repair contracting business. And he had been, the Ellises like to travel a lot, and he'd been house sitting for them while they were gone. And this immediately opened up the case. They tracked down Larry Jean Bell. They set up a roadblock, arrested him the next day. So then John went back to the sheriff's department and told them how to stage the scene, that they should go to a room in the back and put all kinds of files in and boxes and all kinds of things to make it clear that they had a voluminous amount of evidence. And the detectives tried to talk to Bell for many hours, really got nothing out of him. So they said, "John, why don't you take a chance, take a shot?" So John and Ron Walker went into Sheriff McCarty's office, and they were sitting on a sofa, and McCarty said, as John describes it, said to them, "You see these two guys over here? They're from the FBI, and they've come out with a profile, and it fits you perfectly," and really trying to intimidate him. So then they all left, and John and Ron were left alone with Larry Jean Bell, and John started explaining to him how the profiling system worked and how they came up with each of these elements. And then he said, "You know, I think that maybe you didn't understand what was going on. Maybe there was, you know, you have split personality, all these kind of things." And finally, Larry Jean Bell said, "Well, the good Larry Jean Bell never could have done this. But the bad Larry Jean Bell, maybe he did." That was as close as they ever got to a confession. But at that point, the evidence was overwhelming. I haven't even mentioned all of the physical evidence that they got from the mattress that Larry Jean Bell was sleeping on, that they found some of Sherry Smith's hairs on it. They found his semen, all kinds of things. So after John's interrogation, he and Metz decided, "All right, let's bring the family in." And they brought Bob and Hilda and Dawn in to confront him. And they confronted him, and he said, "Why did you do it?" And all of that. Why did you? And while he didn't admit anything, it was clear two things. First of all, it was clear that he was deeply affected by all this, and that he was also, as we had found, obsessed with Dawn. And one of the reasons we know that John's tactic was effective, because when John asked him about this memorial service, it turns out that Larry Jean Bell was there, but he was in his car, and it was too far from the gravesite, the road, and he was afraid to get out. So as John had predicted, he would be there. They just couldn't find him that way. And when John said, in trying to get him to admit anything, he said, "Larry, when did you start feeling bad about these murders?" And he said, "When I saw the memorial service." So that clearly had gotten to him. And at the same time, he was obsessed with Dawn.
So ultimately, he's indicted for two murders for both of the women, young women who were abducted and he killed. And of course, went to trial, and the trials were a circus.
And he made just a total mockery of the trials. I mean, it was all about him. He wouldn't be constrained by the judge. They eventually had to threaten him in all kinds of different ways and finally take him out. He would keep saying things like, when they asked him questions, he would say, "Silence is golden," or other epigrammatic statements like that. And then in what was just the ultimate part of it was, on the stand proposed to Dawn, who was sitting in the seats, and said, "Will you marry me? You know, I want you to marry me." And, you know, it was just incredible. Now, what all this bizarre behavior does is, I mean, it certainly doesn't endear him to the judge or the jury, but then you have to wonder, is this guy just so bonkers out of his mind that he will be found not guilty by reason of insanity? Now, insanity is a very interesting concept in the law, because it's not a medical term. And basically, we can go all the way back to the McNaughton case in England, where Daniel McNaughton tried to assassinate Prime Minister Sir Robert Peel and end up, in fact, killing his private secretary. Now, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity, and the test was essentially, can you tell the difference between right and wrong? And are you able to conform your behavior to the dictates of society? That essentially, even though it's gone through many permutations, is still the definition that we use for insanity. Now, his lawyer tried to show that Larry Jean Bell must have been insane to do all these bizarre things. He essentially conceded that Larry Jean Bell had done it. I mean, the evidence was overwhelming. But he tried to show somebody this bizarre must be insane. And on the other side, people like John, who testified, said he planned this out very well. He was meticulous in everything he did. He avoided capture. He knew to wipe the telephone apparatus that he was using. He used a voice modifier, all kinds of things. And eventually, both juries, in two separate trials, the trial for the murder of Sherry Smith and the trial for the murder of 9-year-old Deborah Mae Helmick, he was found guilty of murder in the first degree. And eventually, to everyone's great satisfaction, in the early 90s, he was executed. Now, what's interesting is by that point, South Carolina had eliminated the electric chair and had instituted lethal injection as the method of execution. However, anybody who had been sentenced while they still had the electric chair could opt for that manner of execution, which Larry Jean Bell did. Now, we don't know why exactly, except two things. One is he associated the wooden electric chair with the cross thought that, you know, he was dying just like Jesus had, which of course is the ultimate in narcissism and bizarre behavior. And also, I speculate, and I think John speculated, that he was an electrician by trade. Could it be that he just felt comfortable with electricity? I don't know. But he did believe that once he was executed, once he died, he would go to heaven, which of course is a bizarre concept for somebody like that anyway. He believed that the two, the girl and the woman who he had killed, plus, we believe, three others, unsolved cases in nearby counties that he that had gone missing under similar circumstances and that he had some connection with. He believed that those would be, you know, his, I don't know what you want to call it, sex slaves, concubines, partners, whatever, in heaven. So there's no question this guy was bizarre. No question in my mind that he was mentally ill. But that didn't mean he was insane, Jim. It meant that he was still able to understood what he was doing, conform his behavior to the dictates of society, and understood right from wrong. He just didn't care. In my mind, in John's mind, and in the two juries' minds, Larry Jean Bell was mentally ill, but he was clearly understanding what he did. And he did it because that was what was important to him. And like so many serial killers, it's all about them. Everybody else is just an object, a prop to be used.
As we talked earlier, the phone calls that Bell made with the family were horrible and gut-wrenching. And even in one, he describes how he killed Sherry to family members who were on the phone. And you have you actually have the transcript in the book.
Okay, Jim, I'm going to read you the dialogue. Well, I want to say something to you that she told me. Okay. Oh boy. Sherry Faye said that she did not cry the entire time, Dawn. She was very strong-willed, and she said that she did not want you all to ruin your lives and to go on with your lives like the letter said. And I've never lied to you all, right? Everything I've told you came true, right? Yes. Okay, this is going to have to be the way it is. And she said that she wasn't scared, that she knew she was going to be an angel. And if I took the latter choice she suggested to me, that she would forgive me. But God's going to be the major judgment, and she'll probably end up seeing me in heaven, not in hell. So, I mean, the narcissism of this guy is just amazing. And also the sadism that he is talking in such calm, ordinary terms to his family. He then goes on. Dawn says, but Sherry was not afraid and she didn't cry or anything. No, she didn't do anything. And can you handle it if I tell you how she died? Yes. Okay, now be strong. Okay. She said you were strong. She told me all about the family and everything. We talked and, oh God, and I'm a family friend. That's the sad part. You were a family friend? Of course he wasn't a family friend. This is just him insinuating himself into this. So again, another example of his extreme narcissism, which I can't stress enough. He goes on, yeah, and that's why I can't face y'all. You'll find out in the morning or tomorrow. But forgive me. I don't know whether you should tell your mother this or not, but Sherry Fay was not a virgin. We don't believe that's true, by the way. I did make love to her, and we had oral sex for three different times, and she died. Can you handle this now? Yes. This, again, another unless he sexually abused her forcibly, this is a total fantasy on his part. Okay. I tied her up to the bedpost and with electrical cord, and she didn't struggle or cry or anything. She let me voluntarily from her chin to her head, okay? Okay, I'll go ahead and tell you. And I took duct tape and I wrapped it all the way around her head and suffocated her. And tell the coroner or get the information. That's how she died. And I was not aware that she had this disease. This was a form of diabetes that she had. I probably wouldn't have ever taken her. He then asks the family to pray for him. I mean, all kinds of things like this. It's just an amazing story. And when you compare him, this totally self-centered guy who, for his own evil, nefarious purposes, has to kill this totally innocent, lovely young woman, and you compare her who's able to, knowing that he's going to kill her, right, who's able to write this last will and testament and try to give her parents, her sister, her brother, her boyfriend, some kind of lasting peace. I mean, it's just incredible. I mean, I would have to say this last will and testament that she wrote, which ultimately, ironically, did lead to her killer, although nobody knew that at the time. This is probably the most searing, gut-wrenching, heart-rending, and yet meaningful and faith-inducing pieces of evidence I've ever seen in my 25-year career of writing about criminal justice.
So in this case, Mark, the physical evidence that was developed plus the profile, the two of them together made this case possible to be solved.
So in other words, without the physical evidence, they might not have, with the will, as you mentioned, Jim, they might not have been able to track him down. Without the profile, they wouldn't have been able to identify him. And without the dogged police work from the sheriff's office, from SLED, from the local police departments, I mean, all of that worked together to stop a serial killer in his tracks. Because there is no question in my mind or anybody else's that Larry Jean Bell would have continued as long as he could. This was a guy who couldn't have had these beautiful women on his own, and yet he fantasized that this is, you know, these were his women. And, you know, then you say, well, why did he pick on Deborah Helmick, 9 years old? And I think the answer is twofold. First of all, she was a beautiful young girl, but second of all, she was vulnerable. Because as a 9 year old, if he had been looking at her, following her, just as he had followed Sherry Fay for several hours beforehand after he saw her at a shopping mall, if he'd been following Deborah May, he knew she would be an easy catch. And he had planned it early on. He had changed license plates on his car so he couldn't be identified. Another example of how he wasn't insane. And he was able to snatch Deborah May in front of witnesses, including her younger brother, and when her father came out right away, it was too late. He was already gone. So there's some more examples.
And Mark, what of the two families? How did they fare at the end of the trials?
Deborah Helmick's mother said she couldn't forgive the crime, but she would forgive Larry Jean Bell because it was just too hard for her to keep all of this inside her. Generally, one of two things happens in the murder of children. The parents either become closer with each other, pull together, or this trauma rips them apart. We have one of each. In the Helmick case, unfortunately, mother and father did end up divorcing, and the strain was just too much for them. The Smiths became even closer, if that was possible. They continued with their various ministries for schools, for prisons. Eventually, Hilda eventually died of cancer in the early 2000s. Bob remarried, continued with what he was doing. Dawn, it's kind of an inspiring story. She was ready to give up, and then she realized she had to keep going for her sister. She was very beautiful, like Sherry. She entered beauty contests. She won at the local level. She became Miss South Carolina. She went on to Miss America with her talent was was classical opera. She came in, I think, third in Miss America, and went on to found a ministry based on her singing and based on her faith. And that ministry continues to this day.
Mark, we often lose the victim's story in recounting the crimes of sexual assault and murder. Now, although Murder Most Foul often concentrates on the perp, I have published two segments that featured survivors of Ted Bundy. The honesty and resilience of these two brave women floored me.
Jim, I completely agree with you on every count. And one of the things which has struck me in my study of criminal behavior and true crime and criminal investigative analysis is how courageous and full of grace the victims and their families so often are. The courage to go on is just staggering. And when you think of what they've been through, when you think of what has destroyed so much of their lives and left such a gaping hole, the fact that they can go on, that they can continue and not be literally insane themselves is just a testament to the human spirit. And I think the people that I've met in the course of my work who have been crime victims and know crime victims and supported crime victims, whether they are the victims themselves, the parents or survivors, the victim witness unit supporters, the detectives, the prosecutors, all of them, it just gives me such tremendous sense of the courage and the ability of the human spirit to rise to the occasion. And I am continually inspired by these people.
Well, Mark, I couldn't have said it better myself. Let me catch me up on your partner in crime. What's John Douglas up to these days?
John and I, we talk about other books we may want to write. John still consults. He has done master class on profiling, which has been extremely popular. I recommend it to everyone. And John and I are now talking about starting a Substack column where we talk about all of the things which we've learned over all these years.
Well, busy, busy, busy. But I'm so happy you were able to find some time to spend with me and my audience on Murder Most Foul. Again, the book, which is just amazing in detail and heart, is called When a Killer Calls by John Douglas and Mark Olshaker. So look it up online, get it at your library like I did. And once again, thanks, Mark, from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you, Jim. It was a pleasure to be with you as always.
So I'd like to thank you folks for kindly tuning in for another episode of Murder Most Foul. If you liked what you heard, I hope you'll tell your friends. Information about the podcast and an email link that can get a message to me can be found at the podcast's website, the address being www.murdermostfoul.com. So until we meet again, stay safe, and for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.